as I was thinking over the weekend about this opportunity and what I wanted to say to you today, I was trying to come up with a unifying theme, you know, something that would pull together all the disparate strands into at least a somewhat coherent whole. And as I was thinking about that, trying to do that, suddenly this insight occurred to me. Immigration detention is just like prison, only without the good parts. And even though that was a laugh line, and thank you to those of you who didn't laugh, I actually mean that quite sincerely and seriously. And what I mean by that is that immigration detention is like prison in ways that it should not be. And it's not like prison in ways that it should be, and in ways that would be helpful and actually more rights protective than the current system. Now, as you probably all know, immigration detention is civil in nature. And although some people in immigration detention have been convicted of crimes, and in many cases that's why they are now facing deportation, they're not in detention pursuant to their criminal convictions. So what does it mean that detention is civil in nature? Well, as a matter of U.S. constitutional law, it means that detainees in immigration detention may not be punished. And any conditions of confinement that constitute punishment are unconstitutional. Now, by contrast, convicted prisoners can be punished, and only conditions that constitute cruel and unusual punishment are prohibited in their case. So on the one hand, you have immigration detainees protected by the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment against any punishment at all. And on the other hand, you have convicted prisoners protected by the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the Eighth Amendment only against conditions that constitute cruel and unusual punishment. So these are two very different standards. And while some courts have tended to sort of collapse them together and just apply the lower Eighth Amendment standard to everyone, other courts, most notably the Ninth Circuit, have given real content to this distinction. And in fact, in the Ninth Circuit, persons held civilly, and that includes immigration detainees, are entitled to better conditions even than pretrial criminal detainees, people who have not yet been convicted and are still presumed to be innocent, and certainly better conditions than convicted prisoners. So this is the legal theory, but the reality is that the criminal incarceration has really been the default model for immigration detention. And the most notable way in which this is apparent is the fact that most facilities where immigration detainees are held are in fact prisons and jails that simply rent bed space to ICE, to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the agency that is in charge of immigration detention. And in these facilities, in these prisons and jails, immigration detainees are mixed with both pretrial criminal detainees and convicted prisoners. And they experience a physical plant and facilities and rules and regulations and programs that are designed for criminal prisoners. Now, on the other hand, there are features of well-run prison systems that immigration detention lacks. Now, I want to be careful not to overstate this, because obviously there are huge problems in U.S. prisons, and as Doug mentioned, I've spent much of my career as a prisoner's rights litigator challenging those conditions. But that said, for whatever reason, and I think that it's at least in part because of years of litigation, U.S. prisons have become professionalized and bureaucratized, and that has been a very good thing. Prisons have become an industry, and like any other industry, it has standards. And that is also a good thing, even if the standards are often not actually met in practice. Now, by contrast, immigration detention, in terms of its professionalization, is probably where prisons were a generation ago or even more. And paradoxically, I think that both of these phenomena, on the one hand, the reflexive defaulting to the prison model, while on the other hand, lacking the professionalization of many prison systems, I think these both come and result from the same root cause. And that's the fact that immigration detention on any significant scale is really quite a new phenomenon in this country. The average daily population in immigration detention, the number of people who are actually in detention on any given day, has more than quadrupled from about 7,500 in 1995 to about 31,000 today, which makes it the fastest growing form of incarceration in the United States. But despite that rapid recent growth, it's still a relatively recent phenomenon. And certainly it is still dwarfed by the population of our prisons and jails, which on any given day are over 2.3 million. So the 31,000 in immigration detention really pales beside this much, much larger number of people in prisons and jails. Now, both of these themes are really laid out very well in this very useful document. This is a report that was released October 6th, so just 2 weeks ago today, by the Department of Homeland Security. And it was prepared by Dora Shariro, who was until very recently director of ICE's Office of Detention Policy and Planning. And I really recommend this document to you. It's about 30 pages long. It's available on the DHS website as a succinct and really pretty accurate account of what is wrong with immigration detention in the United States today. Before coming to DHS, Dr. Shariro was a prison administrator and quite a progressive and well-respected and enlightened one. She ran the Missouri prison system and more recently the Arizona system, and then essentially came with Janet Napolitano to Washington when Ms. Napolitano became Secretary of DHS. And in this report, Dr. Shariro really identifies the ways in which ICE has inappropriately adopted the criminal model for detention. And she points out all the ways in which that model is inappropriately restrictive for a civil detention system of immigrants. The populations are obviously different in very significant ways, and she makes, from her vantage point as an experienced prison administrator, quite a convincing case that this model is just not what we should be using to detain civil immigration detainees. But she also points out with what I think at some points is pretty thinly disguised horror, the very basic tools that every prison system has, but ICE still lacks. So, for example, ICE lacks a risk assessment instrument. This is essentially a scoring tool that's used to tell which detainees pose a high risk of assault or violence or escape, and which are lower risk and therefore more appropriate.
Thanks very much.
Therefore more appropriate for either lower custody, housing, or actually community supervision, electronic monitoring, alternatives to detention. A medical classification system. ICE doesn't have this either. This is a system whereby you identify detainees who have serious medical or mental health or dental problems that need to be taken into account in where they're housed and other aspects of how their case is managed. Something as simple as an online locator system so that lawyers can find their clients, family members can find their loved ones. Now, these are basic things in the correction world. And when we met, as part of her research that resulted in this report, Dr. Shariro met with many NGOs, including Human Rights Watch. And when we met with her, she was really even more frank than she is in this report about her shock and dismay when she arrived at DHS to find that these basic tools were lacking in immigration detention. So with that frame, that immigration detention is like prison only without the good parts, let me talk a little bit about two sets of human rights problems in immigration detention that we've worked on and are still working on at Human Rights Watch. One is an area in which immigration detention resembles prison in a bad way, and one is an area in which it would actually be a significant improvement if ICE were to start to operate more like at least the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Now, in March of this year, we released a report on healthcare for women in immigration detention, and we found some pretty serious deficiency. This is the report. It's called Detained and Dismissed, Women's Struggles to Obtain Healthcare in United States Immigration Detention, and you can find this in all our reports on our website, hrw.org. Now, obviously, there are significant problems in healthcare in ICE detention across the board, and if you've at all been paying attention to this, you know there have been a number of deaths. There have been a lot of reports. Both the Washington Post and the New York Times have devoted a lot of coverage to this. But in this report, we focused primarily on women's special healthcare needs, and we found that those needs are often not being met in ICE detention, and sometimes in ways that have quite serious consequences. So, for example, we found that women have difficulty obtaining basic preventive care, like pap smears and mammograms. They have difficulty getting hormonal contraceptives, even when those contraceptives have been prescribed by an outside physician to manage a specific medical condition. Care for pregnant detainees, of which there are a significant number, was systematically inadequate. New mothers were denied access to breast pumps, and in some cases, women were even denied sanitary pads. Now, as I said, medical care in detention has a lot of problems, and there are multiple causes for this. But I think it's clear that one explanation for the deficiencies we found in women's health care specifically is that in immigration detention, like in criminal incarceration, the model, the prototype, is male. And women are, at best, an afterthought. Women are only about 9% of the detained immigrant population. And as recently as 2001, the number was even lower. They were about 7%. And this already small female population is dispersed among about 150 different facilities. And again, these are mostly state prisons, county jails, where ICE rents bed space. And so you have a lot of facilities where there are literally just two or three or four female detainees. So when the healthcare system was set up, it's a good bet that no one was really focused on women and their special healthcare needs, and what adjustments to the default model needed to be made to take that into account. And the best evidence of this, I think, is the fact that ICE has healthcare standards, but they don't have a single healthcare standard that is specifically about women's healthcare needs. And this is something that we see in the prison system, too, where, again, the population is overwhelmingly male, and historically, little attention has been paid to the special health care needs of women. Now, ironically, the prisons are getting better at this because of the unfortunate fact that in recent years, the female criminal incarcerated population has actually been growing faster than the male. So women now make up a larger percentage of the prison population, although still relatively very small, still below 10% of the total. Now, the good news is that one of the recommendations of the Sharira report is to develop specific plans for serving special populations, which includes women. And she also recommends consolidating the female population at a smaller number of facilities so that there will be sort of critical mass of women at a few facilities, and it'll be easier in that way, the thinking goes, to meet their needs more effectively. Now let me switch to an area where it would actually be an improvement if ICE were to become more like a well-run prison system. And let's take the Federal Bureau of Prisons as an example. We are about to release in the next 5 or 6 weeks a report on transfers in immigration detention, the phenomenon by which detainees are transferred from one facility to another. Now, obviously, in any system of detention, whether it's civil or criminal, where there are multiple facilities, some transfers will be inevitable. And certainly, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which, like ICE, operates a national system, although it's a much larger system, the Bureau has over 200,000 prisoners compared to, as I said, about 31,000 in ICE detention. The Bureau, which runs a national system, certainly transfers people. But transfers in immigration detention are actually less regulated, and they end up violating human rights in a number of ways. So the prototypical case, the most common scenario we see, is that when people are picked up for immigration violations, they will initially be detained close to where they were arrested, which is usually where they were living, and is also usually a large urban area like New York or Los Angeles. But because ICE has a shortage of bed space in these areas, they are often transferred within a few weeks, hundreds or even thousands of miles away to places like Texas or Louisiana or Florida. So what are the effects of this? First of all, it has a devastating effect on the right of immigrant detainees to be represented by counsel. Now, under U.S. law, immigrants in removal proceedings have no right to appointed counsel, so they're unlike criminal detainees, criminal defendants in that respect. But they do have a right to be represented by counsel if they can obtain counsel at no cost to the government. And under Section 13 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is a human rights treaty ratified by the United States, there is a similar right to representation in removal proceedings. So what we find is that detainees are quite often able to find counsel when they're first detained. Typically, they're detained close to home, and with the help of their family, their friends, their church, their social club, their network of contacts, because some of these people have been living in this country, some of them have been in this country legally, some of them have been here for years or even decades. So with the help of their social networks, they're often able to find counsel initially. But then they're transferred far away, and that almost invariably severs any attorney-client relationship they've been able to establish. Long-distance representation is difficult under the best of circumstances, and some immigration judges simply will not permit attorneys to appear telephonically or by video. And so in those cases, continued representation becomes essentially rendered impossible by the fact of the transfer. In addition, detainees are often transferred away from areas that are relatively rich in pro bono or low-cost legal resources to remote rural areas where those resources are, where there are very few or no such resources. So the chances of finding counsel in the new location are often pretty low, and the fact is that many immigrants do go all the way through their removal proceedings entirely without representation by counsel. Transfers also make it much more difficult for detainees to present evidence in their efforts to defend against deportation or removal. Typically, the witnesses that are crucial on a whole range of issues, the detainee's moral character, whether deportation would result in unusual hardship, even in some cases, the detainee's claim to U.S. citizenship. These witnesses will typically all be located where the detainee lived and where he or she was initially arrested. So transfer to a remote location, again, when you combine it with the refusal of some judges to allow testimony by video or telephone, really can make it effectively impossible for an immigrant to mount any kind of defense to the government's efforts to remove him or her. And finally, transfer can actually change the substantive law that applies to an immigrant's case. Obviously, there are a lot of legal variables that determine the outcome of an immigrant's case, whether he or she is able to successfully resist deportation. And the law is not uniform among the various federal circuits. So, for example, for those who are facing deportation because of a criminal conviction, the decisive question really is whether their criminal conviction constitutes what's called an aggravated felony. And if it does, there really are relatively few defenses to deportation available. By contrast, if your conviction is not an aggravated felony, there are more possible defenses to deportation. And the circuits are all over the place on what constitutes an aggravated felony. Now, when I was at the Supreme Court last week watching the argument in Padilla versus Kentucky, and you might have heard about this case. This is the case of a legal Honduran immigrant to this country, lived in this country lawfully, as a lawful immigrant for 40 years, fought in the U.S. military in the Vietnam War, and was eventually arrested on drug charges. And he was offered a plea deal, and he specifically asked his criminal defense lawyer, "I'm an immigrant, I'm not a citizen, will accepting this plea deal affect my immigration status?" And his lawyer says, "No, you've been here so long, it won't have any effect at all, don't you worry about it." So he accepted the plea deal, and in fact, the crime to which he pled guilty subjects him to mandatory detention and mandatory deportation once he's finished serving his criminal sentence. And the question before the court in this case was whether this extraordinarily bad legal advice by his criminal defense lawyer constitutes ineffective assistance of counsel that would allow him to withdraw his guilty plea. But in the course of this argument at the court, at one point, Justice Ginsburg, who was trying to be helpful, said, "Well, it's really not too much to expect criminal defense lawyers to know this stuff. I mean, it's either an aggravated felony or it's not. It's very simple," is what she said. Well, in fact, it's not at all simple. And as I said, there are circuit disagreements on whether a given crime is an aggravated felony or not. And we have found in our research that will be presented in this report, we found cases where a detainee's conviction would not have been an aggravated felony in the circuit where he was first detained, but was in the circuit to which he was transferred. So he ended up, in quite a literal sense, the transfer ended up resulting in his mandatory deportation. Now, I mean, of course, it could theoretically work the other way, too. I mean, an inter-circuit transfer could result in a change in the law that's favorable to the detainee. But we're still analyzing the data. There are about 1.4 million transfers that have taken place in the last 10 years in the immigration system, and we're still crunching those numbers. But we suspect that when we're done, we will find a net flow of detainees out of the relatively detainee-friendly Second and Ninth Circuits and into the implacably hostile Fifth Circuit. And I'm not suggesting, by the way, I'm not suggesting that there's anything sort of deliberate or nefarious or sinister about that. It's simply the fact that ICE has a shortage of bed space in California and the Northeast, and they have a lot of bed space in Texas. So that's where they end up sending people. So these transfers, I think you can see, present human rights problems, threats to human rights in a variety of ways. And here's an area where the immigration system would actually be improved if it were to become more like a well-run prison system. Because criminal defendants have a constitutional right, to be tried by a jury of the jurisdiction in which the alleged crime occurred, they're almost always detained in that jurisdiction for the duration of their trial. And it almost never happens that a criminal defendant is transferred thousands of miles away from his attorney in the middle of his criminal trial. By contrast, that happens all the time to immigration detainees. In fact, in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, even after the trial is over and the defendant has been convicted, BOP policy provides that transfers should be avoided during the period that's necessary to prepare an appeal. So another safeguard that's present in the prison system, not in ICE. And again, here the Shariro report acknowledges this problem and recommends restricting transfers of immigration detainees who are represented by counsel. But again, at this point, that is only a recommendation and has not yet been translated into policy. So, We have a new administration, a new president, a new Secretary of Homeland Security. What does the future hold? Well, in the last couple of months, the Department of Homeland Security has announced plans for significant reforms to immigration detention. And as Doug said at the outset, those reforms are described or summarized as moving the system more closely into line with ICE's civil detention authority. So, for example, they specifically said that at least in the long term, they will no longer rely primarily on renting excess capacity from prisons and jails. They will instead have facilities that are dedicated to specifically to immigration detention purposes. They've also said they will develop standards, detention standards, that are specific to ICE's detention mission rather than essentially adopting criminal standards, which has been the practice so far. And that's a very good thing if it's followed through on and actually done. But some of the reforms actually adopt some of the best practices from the prison model that I've mentioned. So, for example, ICE has said they will finally develop a risk assessment instrument and a custody classification system. Now, it's hard for people who haven't worked in the sort of criminal justice biz to understand just how basic this is on the criminal side. I mean, the most podunk rural county jail will have, or at least will claim to have, a risk assessment instrument and a classification system, some way to separate dangerous, violent detainees from those who are not. ICE, to this day, does not have such a system. A medical classification system, again, very basic on the criminal side. ICE doesn't yet have one. And finally, they've said they will actually develop an online locator system so that counsel and family and friends can find detainees after these frequent transfers, and staff time isn't used up answering telephone inquiries and mail inquiries about location. Now, obviously, the big question is, what are the prospects that these announced plans will actually ripen into reality? And I think it's hard to say. Many of us were very encouraged at the choice of Dora Schriro to be the point person on detention reform. And as I said, I think her report is an accurate account of what's wrong and a good blueprint for what needs to be done. I do think it's a bad sign that she abruptly quit her position just a few weeks ago, less than 8 months after beginning. I have no special insight. This is just a guess, but I just have a feeling that that does not bode well for long-term reform of immigration detention. I think the bottom line is that there are people who want to do the right thing. There are people who know that there are problems that need to be fixed. But how much of that is accomplished depends on how much freedom of movement they have in light of everything else that the administration and even just the Department of Homeland Security wants to accomplish in the next 3.5 years. And obviously, the 2010 elections are a non-trivial variable that will play into this also. So I wish I could leave you with something more definitive than time will tell. But I'm afraid that's where we are. So thanks very much for your attention. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, I'll moderate and take some questions, but I'm going to launch one that I think may be helpful for a law school audience to kind of understand the framework of it. As a litigator, you've talked about these problems and challenging the prison systems. Maybe expand a little bit about why these bad policies that would seem to border on, well, or you've said, violate international human rights law or norms, why is there not a basis upon which you can challenge some of this stuff in our U.S. courts? And why are we always in kind of a policy debate here? Why don't you have your litigation toolbox out? And then I'll try to think that's going to be
powerful. As I said, immigration detainees are covered by a more protective standard, the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. But in many of the challenges that we've seen to court challenges brought to immigration detention conditions, the courts have either explicitly or in fact applied the Eighth Amendment standard. The cruel and unusual punishments clause that applies to protect to convicted prisoners. And that standard is really not terribly protective. It is certainly much less protective than international human rights law in a couple of important ways. First of all, the Eighth Amendment applies only to, it is triggered only by the deprivation of what the court calls the minimal civilized measures of life's necessities, basic human needs. Food, shelter, clothing, medical care, reasonable safety from physical attack. The Eighth Amendment has not been interpreted to protect what I'll call, for lack of a better term, dignitary interests, the essential dignity of every person. And it's been held not to prescribe conditions that, while disgusting and degrading and humanizing, don't result in the deprivation of a serious basic human need. By contrast, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, again, a treaty that the United States has ratified and therefore has the status of federal, supreme federal law, provides that any kind of detention system has to be have as its touchstone the basic human dignity of every person. And both the ICCPR and the Convention Against Torture, another human rights treaty ratified by the United States, prohibit cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. So even on its face, that is a much more protective standard than cruel and unusual punishment. So the short answer is just that our domestic constitution is much less protective than these human rights treaties to which we are a party.
Yes. With the ICCPR in particular, and I believe the Geneva Conventions as well, isn't there an argument, and isn't the Supreme Court taking a stance that if the treaty is not self-executing, then it's not binding federal law, that domestic law would trump it?
You know, the Supreme Court has never really...
That's what Medellin was all about, wasn't it?
Right, yeah, in terms of the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations.
Right, in terms of when a treaty is binding domestic federal law and when regular domestic law would supersede that.
You know, it's the reason I'm hesitating is because it is binding. Even in Medellin, the court did not dispute that this is binding law. That.
But if there's federal law on point.
No, it's still binding law. Now, a subsequent statute, you know, could modify the effect of the treaty. But it is binding law. What it's not self-executing means is that it can't be relied upon by litigants. That's the distinction. It is binding, and no one, I don't think any of the justices in Medellin disputed that the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations was a binding legal obligation on the United States. What the holding was that, you know, Jose Medellin couldn't rely upon it in litigation, challenging his death sentence. So, you were thinking about asking a question?
No, just listening.
Here's one.
Any question?
Kind of 2 points.
Yeah.
Now with the person having quit her job, mm-hmm. You know, you finally had a real shoe in. You know, you advocated for her and she had taken a position and come out with this brilliant report. Where does the community go now in trying to find an individual and to hold that individual to that report mm-hmm. in the next go-round? So that's one question. The second mm-hmm. question is, has anyone looked at the medical consequences of these multiple transfers or these millions of transfers within the system? Mm-hmm. You know, I know Alan Keller has done
yeah.
stuff on the health consequences
sure.
of minus detention.
Mm-hmm.
Has anyone looked at the medical consequences mm-hmm. of transfer within the system? And could that body of information mm-hmm. be helpful in an argument against transfer? So there's both a legal reason mm-hmm.
sure.
and there would be a medical.
A more, yeah, pragmatic public health reason.
Right.
To answer your second question first, I don't know of anyone who has specifically looked at that, but given the very serious deficiencies in ICE medical care across the board, I'm sure those the consequences are substantial, because among the findings set forth in this report is the fact that ICE has no policy on maintenance of medical records. Medical record does not accompany the detainee on transfer. Even the summary of the medical record that is supposed to accompany the detainee on transfer often does not. So I'm sure that if someone were to look at this, that they could find quite serious consequences as a result.
Which would be good.
It would be, sure, yeah.
Important work to do.
Absolutely. No, that's a very important point.
And I ask that because I'm a physician.
Yeah.
And my first assignment evaluation was on a woman from Algiers who was just absolutely hysterical because she had been gang raped. And we actually got her freed through the asylum process because of her need for medical care that we were certain she could not get in the INS detention center itself.
That's an excellent point, and another major deficiency of medical care in ICE is the psychiatric care for people who have experienced very serious trauma. You know, this is certainly an issue for asylum seekers who almost by definition have had bad things happen to them, but also even some non-asylum seekers have crossing the border, people who cross the U.S.-Mexican border, sexual abuse at the border by coyotes or others is endemic, so this is a real need, which is also, I'm sorry to say, not being well met. And as for your first question, I don't know. I mean, it really is, it's kind of a moving target right now, and we don't know who is going to be the new person, if any, playing this role. But I think you're right. I mean, you identify the challenge, which is to hold them.
Report, I mean, maybe the Shiro report, the major legacy is the fact that report is now a federal crime.
Right. It's out there in the public domain, and although the last page consists of all these disclaimers that it creates no rights and is her personal opinion and so on and so forth, you can't unring the bell, and it's out there. Exactly. You had a question.
So, me?
You, yes.
Okay. I wondered in your research, have you undertaken a comparative analysis with countries in Europe that have big immigration problems like France and the United Kingdom, and how they've dealt with federal wars with the detention centers and treatment?
We haven't done a direct, sort of side-by-side comparison, which I think that would be a very interesting thing to do. We have a separate refugee program, a Human Rights Watch, that has looked at the treatment of refugees by a number of European countries. And I'm sorry to say that really no one covers themselves in glory when it comes to treatment of refugees. One of my colleagues just recently did a report on treatment of refugees by Greece, and it was very disturbing what he found. And as you may know, there's just been a change of government in Greece, and the new government has said, you know, we know there's problems, we're going to do better, we agree this is unacceptable. So, no, we have not done side by side, but again, there are many countries that have real, whose treatment of immigrants and refugees raises serious human rights concerns. Yeah?
Have you been able to study the sort of success rate of motions to transfer venue once a detainee has been transfer out of one jurisdiction and then you want to get back. How successful are those? Is it very against prejudice? And you have an analysis of it in your report.
But. Yeah, there is information on that in the report. The short answer is they are, motions to transfer venue back are almost never successful. In fact, there have been cases where immigration judges have specifically said, I basically don't grant motions to change of venues filed by the detainee. And, they've later been told, by a higher tribunal, no, you really can't have an across-the-board policy of only granting motions by one side, but they're almost never granted. And that's why that transfer is a moment of surpassing importance in the detainee's case, because once the transfer occurs, the chances of getting it reversed are almost nil. There have been cases, and we profile a couple of them in the report, but they're very, very few and far between. Yes?
What are the variations between treatment in different facilities around the country?
Well, the variations are substantial because ICE holds detainees in essentially four different kinds of facilities. There are the largest number, as I said, are held in contracted bed space in local prisons and jails, so that's one. ICE does operate some facilities on its own, so that's two. ICE holds some people in, some detainees in facilities run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons by interagency agreement between DHS and the Department of Justice, which operates the Bureau of Prisons. And finally, it houses a number of detainees in private for-profit prisons with which, again, it contracts for bed space. So these are private facilities run by the Corrections Corporation of America or GEO Group, private prison operators. So you really do see quite a range of conditions and treatment in every respect, given the huge variety of facilities in which people are held. And another sort of variable is that in some of these facilities, the Division of Immigrant Health Services, which is part of the Department of Human Services, provides medical care, whereas in others, in many of the contract facilities, it's just provided by whatever provider does the care at that jail. So there really are, that's one of the challenges, is that there's such a tremendous variation, and as this report identifies, not a lot of effective oversight to make sure that minimal standards are being met. In the back there.
So to increase it, it's a little bit. Were you in town last night?
I was, yes.
Were you at the incarceration meeting?
Yes, I was.
It struck me when you first were making your remarks that you, in a different context than the movie last night, where you said, because prisons, I apologize for being prepared, but because prisons are an industry, that with that comes with standards, and that's a good thing to have, even if.
They're often not met, yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. And I wonder if you addressed this, and I missed it, because I found myself thinking about that versus last night, where the presentation of it being an industry is very much couched as a bad thing necessarily in a for-profit sort of way. And I wonder, I don't have a direct question, but I'm going to defer to you to find one in there.
Okay.
What sort of parallel about that to you? Did it strike you? When you saw that last night, did you think, I'm about to point out that it being...
Well, I hope I'm not contradicting myself from last night, although that's always possible. When I said today that it's an industry, I wasn't focusing on the sector of it, which is still fairly small, less than 10%. That is a private for-profit corporation. I was talking about maybe a better way of putting it would have been to say it is a substantial sector of the economy that employs a lot of people, that has training academies and professional standards and accreditation and credentialing. So that's what I was getting at, not the fact that it's a part of it is a money-making industry, which I fully agree presents some serious problems. So that's how I would explain it. That's quite all. Yeah.
If others have questions, please step in, but two quick announcements. There's reception following, and so we'll all be outside, and there'll be a bit of casual conversation maybe with David as well. And a couple of announcements. Thursday at same time, not the same room, but somewhere along this corridor, is Professor Karen Musalo, who is one of the leaders in gender asylum and pushing the agenda on that. She'll be speaking at 5 o'clock, and there'll be a reception after that as well. Also, there are several, I think, folks here have done the Care and Attention Project, so the Capital Area Immigrant Rights Coalition. We partner with them, and students volunteer on jail visits, so that is a great way to get inside. And if you are trained, it means a day away, and it's hard to do that with classes, but it is something probably worth doing if you need to do it breaks or in summer. There will be other trains if you haven't done it, and we're hoping also there will be a local facility coming up in Shenandoah Valley in the next month or two. Hopefully the world will be able to do half-day visits. And if there are any other questions, I'd just like to offer one final view, because another conundrum is an activist in trying to deal with the system is, how have you guys dealt with the whole issue of contracts? You say, you know, the Eighth Amendment, that's the standard, but it, you don't infer anything nefarious. Texas is on the border, it makes some sense, but there does seem to be some intent involved in the way they contract. They literally contract and don't include the standards. They won't put the standards into regulations, but then they have contracts not only with private for-profit corporations, but with the local jails. You know, we see it just here in Virginia. The one we used to visit is closed because of one of the detainee deaths you referred to. So how does this intersection of having standards and then having these contracts, because even if they change, they're going to have contracts with these converted nursing homes.
Right.
How does that either connection or disconnection get dealt with, or how do you guys think?
Well, I mean, you've really put your finger on a huge problem, which has multiple levels for at the sort of highest level, the problem is that while ICE has standards, those standards are simply internal guidelines. ICE has refused to promulgate them as federal regulations, which would give them the force of law and give them confer upon them some enforceability. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that some of the contracts with these facilities include compliance with standards as a term of the contract, others don't. And that's also identified in this report as a significant and, I think, fairly obvious failure of oversight. I mean, if you have standards, if the standards are going to mean anything at all, they need to be, and you're contracting out services, the standards need to be part of that contract. So, that is a significant problem, and at least ICE has announced its intention to deal with at least the second part of that, the fact that henceforth the standard should be a term of the contract, but I think they're still holding firm on their refusal to actually make the standards enforceable by the detainees whose rights they are supposed to protect. Yes?
How much of the reform is legislative and how much of it is simply regulatory?
In terms of detention conditions, there's actually a lot that can be done as just a matter of internal agency decision-making that doesn't require legislation. Now, some of it has budgetary implications, and so, of course, Congress would have to appropriate additional funding. But a lot of this is simply about, again, whether the agency chooses to spend its money contracting for jail space and beds or building new facilities that are sort of specifically designed to be immigration detention. So the good news is that a lot of this can be done without legislation, and that's very good news because, everyone's kind of worst nightmare is that this somehow gets entangled with comprehensive immigration reform and then, really abandon hope, all ye who enter here. So we're hoping, again, that notwithstanding Dr. Shiro's sudden departure, we're hoping that there's some internal agency momentum, but so much depends on, again, what Janet Napolitano thinks is really important to address and what she thinks is less important. Yes.
What is the average length of detention?
The mean length of detention is 30 days, but here, as in most cases, means can be very deceptive and essentially meaningless, because there are some people, I think the distribution is at least bimodal, meaning that there's a bunch of people who stay a very short time, and there's a smaller group of people who stay a very long time indeed, and, not many people in between. So to say that the overall mean is 30 days really conveys limited information, and it doesn't really capture the fact that there are some people, albeit a minority, who stay quite a long time. And there's some people who stay a few hours. All right, thanks very much.